I'd read somewhere that since August the 6th, 1945, when the United States dropped the first and one of only two nuclear bombs ever used in warfare, there have been some 125 other wars, none of which used nuclear weapons at all. So the technology of war is by no means limited to the question of nuclear arms. A book by James F. Dunnigan is entitled How to Make War, A Comprehensive Guide to Modern Warfare, All the World's Weapons, Armed Forces, and Tactics. It's full of ripe, friendly wisdom like, a nation rarely goes to war until it has convinced itself that victory is attainable and worth the cost. In reality, warfare is never worth the cost. Real warfare is ugly, destructive, and remembered fondly only by those who survived it without getting too close. Except for the top 10 military nations in the world, effective offensive warfare is not a realistic possibility. The best-dressed army is usually the least effective. Over half the military might in the world is found in the United States and Russia. In 1982, the world spent over $700 billion in armaments, which was more than the equivalent value of the spending in 1944 at the height of the Second World War. Half of that spending was by the United States and Russia. NATO, nearly half, and the Warsaw Pact, one quarter. 6% of the global gross world product goes towards weaponry. 7% in the United States, 14% in the Soviet Union, 3-4% in the NATO countries. During a major war, he expects that nations might devote 30-50% of their gross national product to that effort. In financial terms, World War II has been refought 5 times since 1945.
What do you mean?
The amount of money spent on arms since 1945 is 5 times the amount spent during the Second World War. For 5 years, or more than 10% of the gross national product has been devoted to arms, not only by the Soviet Union, but also by Iraq, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, China, Syria, and North Korea. The only nations of size and importance to spend under 2% were Japan, Canada, Brazil, and Mexico, who are in some way related to the United States for protection. The more expensive weaponry becomes, the less reliable it becomes, in Dunnigan's view, since there are more things to go wrong with it, and since you can afford less testing as the price of that testing goes up, so that weapon systems becoming obsolete in 10 years have taken 8 years to get to the troops. 30 months is the average tenure for the manager of a military product, so they have been overseen by a number of different persons on their way. Therefore, there's an unprecedented number of untried weapons that are replaced by the time the bugs have been worked out of them or before. Any project will cost roughly double the original estimate. And since the number of tests gets less as the price goes up, the weapons get less reliable, likely to be less effective. Nevertheless, weapons have been exported to third world nations to the tune of $5.4 billion in 1980 by the United States, $3.9 billion by the Soviet Union, $1.5 billion by France, $650 million by Britain, $530 million by Italy, and $220 million by West Germany.
US was 5 something, and so the Indian was 3 something?
3.9, nearly 4. So the vast majority has been by the two who also themselves spend the majority of money on armaments in the world. In this unending stream of almost ready weapons that become produced, the United States solves problems of shaky technology with more sophisticated technology. We prefer to develop our own weapons rather than getting weapons from other countries that may already have been more nearly perfected. Being first is expensive and often leads to untrustworthy equipment. Soviet Union, on the other hand, has arms which are crude, unreliable, and less capable than our own. Those arms still outnumber ours, but Dunnigan views the skill of the troops, and particularly their leadership, as being a much more decisive factor than the weapons which are being employed, or sometimes even than the number who are committed to the contest.
Where does he come down then on a decision between the skill of the leadership and that between the two superpowers?
I believe he comes down with the United States having an edge there, that with the vast amount of military personnel in the Soviet Union, with the extent to which they are called upon for labor in factories and agriculture in cases of emergency, with the lack of desire to spend tremendous amounts of money on weapons testing and training, that he considers that not only higher proportion of their weapons would be unusable, but that their troops, although perhaps under control of discipline, would not be necessarily that effective as far as knowing how to do their jobs well. Since these 125 wars since World War II have been fought with weapons and tactics resembling what we've seen in the movies or on television, he has a chapter comparing situations today in the what we call conventional war with those in World War II. Infantry has changed the least, the biggest changes being that nearly all U.S. troops have automatic rifles now, and that radar and other electronic detection devices have made a big difference. Anti-tank weapons he views as less effective because the armor on tanks has been improved more rapidly than the weapons against them. Our infantry is much more mechanized than it was in World War II or than the Soviet Union's is now, using infantry fighting vehicles, which not only help get troops under protection to the front, but are designed for some fighting from within those vehicles, which is less effective than from the outside. They may be used rather like tanks. The increase in speed of Air Force planes to 3 times World War II is not reflected in increased speed during combat, where they can be effective at less than double the World War II speed to have maneuverability and survivability of the equipment. But radar and weapons control systems are very much more sophisticated, but you still can't tell for sure a friend from a foe without visual contact, so that's still an important part of any engagement. Bombs are heavier. Bombers can operate in all weather conditions now, unlike World War II. Air defense is a mixture of World War II type anti-aircraft guns and surface-to-air missiles, which he calls his form of science fiction. Says at least 1 in 50 of those may hit something. Electronic warfare defenses of the aircraft have the upper hand over the missiles to attack them. So pilots trust their lives to black boxes. But if there's a heavy concentration of surface-to-air missiles, they're more likely to send pilotless or drone aircraft and let the machines kill each other off. So much for conventional warfare, unless there are other questions that I might be able to answer from what I have here. Yes?
Do you know what the tank arsenal at Fort Hood is?
No. There are figures in here of the total number of tanks and so forth, but not where they're all deployed.
I've heard that it's one of the largest, you know, concentrations of tanks. There's like more tanks in this one area, and then, you know, just wondered the logic behind having all these tanks on Texas if Mexicans are going to come over the border.
Well, as far as moving them, he figures that 90% of war materials would have to be moved by ship and perhaps 10% by air, that there are very few aircraft that can accommodate a tank, and the ones that can't take anything else along with it, so that it's very unlikely that tanks would be moved quickly to any particular front. And so you either keep them at home, or you figure out in advance where you think they're going to be used and put them there.
Isn't that one of the reasons that the Russians are so big on tanks? They really think they're important because they guard their own borders with tanks.
Exactly. They're surrounded by, if you include in their borders, the borders of the Warsaw Pact nations, they're surrounded by potentially hostile nations, whereas we are at some distance from our most seriously considered major enemies, end quote. Yes. Yes, that's what I was going to move into next. Chemical warfare had its beginning on April 22, 1915 in France, where the German army used chlorine gas on the opposing forces, and was also used on the other side among those who suffered an attack by the British with mustard gas was one corporal named Adolf Hitler, who may have gotten ideas of revenge back at that time. In the First World War, 27% of the casualties on the United States troops were from gas attacks, but less than 2.5% of those were fatal, as against a 28% fatality rate on casualties from other weapons.
That's immediate fatalities.
Yes. As far as shortening of life, it's difficult to say at what time a person would have died had conditions been different. Casualties means some kind of lasting effect, or significant effect at least at the time. In World War II, these weapons were not used for reasons dealing, I believe, both with the fact that your own troops are not necessarily immune if the wind shifts, and in hopes which seemed to be borne out that if neither side used them, the other side would not retaliate with them. But Churchill did insist during World War II on a crash program for biological warfare to spread the disease anthrax by bombs, and there's a small Scottish island which is still contaminated to the point it's uninhabitable from the results of those experiments. Hitler himself vetoed the use of poison gas during World War II, presumably because of fear of retaliation.
He had his in gas chambers.
Yeah, against unarmed opponents, it's safer that way. Far as subsequent work on chemical weapons has been considerable, both by the Soviet Union and the United States. In 1968, some 6,000 sheep in Utah were killed by a leak of nerve gas from the Dugway Proving Ground, and there's been considerable concern for nerve gas canisters that are leaking and need to be taken care of. People who are on the way are not in favor of their being shipped from one place to another. But nerve gas is not the only form of chemical warfare. Back in 1963, a Pentagon scientist expressed the objective of chemical warfare as being the search for something we could spray out of a small atomizer that would cause the enemy to come to our lines with his hands behind his back, whistling the Star Spangled Banner. Along that line of something that might be considered more humane, temporarily incapacitating to be sure, but neither fatal nor permanently damaging, the United States has stocks of tons of an agent called BZ, which is a psychochemical weapon. There was a very extensive article about this in the May issue of Mother Jones magazine. BZ was tested on thousands of American soldiers. It was reportedly used in Vietnam as a counterinsurgency device, and it may have figured as the method that they intended to handle those guarding the hostages in Tehran if the rescue mission had ever gotten that far. And there may be contingency plans to use it in the event of civilian insurrection. The effects of it are imagined like this. You would feel the vaguest of sensations coming over you, tingling, sweating, and gentle trembling. Eventually, a cartoon-like quality would come to the colors around you, which you would seem not to look at, but rather bathe in. You are drawn to an open window. Looking down to the street below, you are treated to a scene that seems straight from a Marx Brothers film directed by Hieronymus Bosch. People with their clothes in disarray, some naked, stagger about, mumbling impromptu speeches. Cars jump the curbs onto the sidewalks and careen randomly into pedestrians, tossing them up like flapjacks. Dozens of citizens, including police officers, sit in the middle of the street, helpless with laughter. Others are whirling and spinning wild in ecstatic St. Vitus's dances. Instinctively, you want to leave this crazy town. Without a thought of what the airport might be like or how you will get there, you bolt out of your apartment barefoot. Hitting the street, you are blown over by the cacophonous roar of mass madness. You join in. LSD was an earlier subject of investigation for psychochemical weapons, but BZ seems to be more reliable in its effects, far cheaper, and according to the article, the CIA is alleged to have about 10 pounds on hand for possible use against insurrection. I don't find the amount that...
Is insurrection a polite word for the kinds of riots we had in the 60s?
It would include anything from that up to a full-scale revolution until the time it became successful, then it's a revolution. Well, now they're intending to phase out BZ because it's exceeded its intended shelf life. it never really quite found its niche in the combat arsenal. In all probability, Vietnam experience showed it to be only marginally effective as a counterinsurgency agent. With the stuff we were handling, a riot like the one at Attica never would have happened. Why kill someone or beat his brains in when all you really need to do is incapacitate him? Question.
How long does the effects, physiological effects of Muzi stay on? If an air, if some helicopter, someone was supposed to, was going to drop that, how long would they be sort of cycle you for?
Couple of days on the average. But I think it's pretty clear that effects of psychically active drugs vary considerably from individual to individual. For some individuals, they are irreversible. Much more in the news has been the questions about nerve gas. Last July, the U.S. House of Representatives rejected the President's call for $54 million to produce binary nerve gas, but authorized $50 million for research and development. Comment that once a thing has been shown to be possible, it generally has been done, quoted in latest issue of Science 82. The word binary in binary nerve gas means that it's made up of two different components, neither of which is deadly by itself, and form nerve gas when they're mixed. And the intention is that the components would be transported separately, assembled in the weapon just before launching, and only after the artillery shell is fired would the components join together. The debate was in Congress wasn't over the need for chemical deterrence weapons, but on the sufficiency of the current stockpile of nerve gas, which is not of the binary kind, and therefore when it leaks in storage, it's as deadly as if it were used in combat, but also on the logistics of shipping binaries in time of war, of fielding untested weaponry and basing those new weapons on European soil, which is where it's expected they would be called on for use, since the Soviet Union allegedly has a decisive military advantage in chemical weapons, and that we need to match what they're doing, contrary to the usual sequence of events that Dan told us in the nuclear arms race on Monday. Fully 90% of the U.S. stockpile is in bulk form or in deteriorating, obsolete, or soon to be obsolete, or unusable munitions, only 10% in weapons with some military utility, and they don't pose a credible deterrent because they're too few in number or too short range to be used against rear echelon targets, which is where you want to use it. You don't want to use it near where your own troops are.
Yep.
Yes?
What's the lethal mechanism on those gas? How does that work on the body, do you know?
Well, I think it attacks either the acetylcholine production mechanism or I guess it's the acetylcholine turnoff mechanism, and so that the nerve impulses are all firing all the time.
Okay, so it'd be probably a cessation of breathing, probably that would kill the person overall.
Complete system shutdown. They work very rapidly. After soliciting for firms to build to produce the binary nerve gas chemicals, the Army found that the big firms generally wouldn't touch the big firms, but that some small companies did seem to be interested in the business.
Did they say why?
Well, the Ethyl Corporation spokesperson would not divulge the firm's reasons for pulling out. As far as Mobil was concerned, the case was closed. Mobile has a known capacity in the area, and the solicitation was sent in the hope the company would change its mind. Mobile does not intend to reply. The company is not interested in it, largely for economic reasons. Not a big enough market, perhaps, for a major company. Well, the purpose of chemical weapons is to attack only troops in a particular area. The effects range from immediate to hours, days, weeks, and years, either into coming into effect or recovering from them. There is protective equipment that is in the hands of some troops. Without protective equipment, effects on the recipients of chemical weapons or be considered to be 70 to 90%, 25% fatalities. With adequate protective equipment, casualties could be limited to under 2%, but it takes a great deal of materiel and training, and the protective gear, you would have to be completely covered up, since many of the agents penetrate the skin as readily as could be inhaled. And so you're slowed down a whole lot in what you're doing if you're wearing that kind of gear, especially at first. It takes time to get it on, so in a surprise attack, there might not be time to do that. Being completely covered up at any temperature above 60 degrees, you're limited to a couple of hours at the outside of the activity before the heat puts you out of action. There is an antidote for nerve gas if you are unprotected and exposed. It has to be injected quite promptly, and the antidote is quite damaging if you miscalculated and were not in fact exposed to nerve gas after all. I will not bother to go through anything about the particular varieties of things, the various forms of nerve gas, some of which is in persistent forms, others non-persistent forms that will rapidly become detoxified just being out in the open. They can be used in lower amounts for harassment or to prevent enemy troops from entering an area as readily, or in more larger amounts to try to actually cause maximum casualties. Even with protective gear, all the equipment has to be decontaminated, as well as the troops, before you can take that gear off, and that takes tremendous amount of chemicals, 320 pounds of a solution to decontaminate one vehicle. If you don't have the solution, you can use water, but it takes a lot more of that. Vision is reduced 25 to 50% by the protective gear, as is voice communication. It's hard to sleep or eat or drink while you're wearing it. Under the heading of chemical warfare, some would place the extensive use by the United States of defoliants in Vietnam, although apart from their effects on the ecosystems there and upon agricultural potentials, the main concern has been with an unintentional impurity in the defoliants, which is nicknamed dioxin. The actual name is somewhat longer, that is among the most toxic materials known. It's of concern also in manufacturing facilities in the United States that make a wide variety of chemical herbicides and other forms of pesticides. There was an explosion in a factory in Italy a few years ago that contaminated many square miles with this material, and they actually dug up several feet of earth and had to bury it someplace else before they were through. Considerable human and animal casualties from that accident. There is considerable difference of opinion, especially between the military authorities and those who might have been exposed, both about lasting effects on the population in Vietnam and on the U.S. troops who were involved in using the material. And that kind of thing is still in legal proceedings, which have not yet been resolved as to what level of responsibility or compensation may become available. The other considerable interest in chemical warfare is with the question of the so-called yellow rain, which has been used allegedly by the Soviet Union or by Vietnam, supplied by the Soviet Union in Cambodia or Kampuchea, in Laos, and in Afghanistan, although the reports from Afghanistan may indicate that it was some other form of stuff. Again, there is difference of opinion as to what the material may be. There have been some positive identifications of particular toxins that come from certain kinds of fungus, which some authorities say could not possibly be endemic in the wet tropical areas where the effects have been reported. The eyewitness accounts say that typically a plane sweeps in low over an isolated village, spraying a yellowish cloud or dropping bombs that burst in a shower of sticky beads. The rain feels, quote, wet like rain and hot like chilies. The lethal ingredient of these mycotoxins or fungal poisons apparently kill by rupturing blood vessels, inhibiting the blood's clotting ability. Within minutes of a yellow rain attack, villagers' eyes start to burn. Soon after that, their skin erupts in blisters, internal bleeding begins, and they vomit blood. Others say that the particular materials that have been positively identified could not possibly act that quickly by themselves. And so there is, a difference of opinion between the pronouncements of the United States, which claims absolute proof of Soviet or Vietnamese use of these, and the Soviet Union that says, no, they come as a result of U.S. activities in Vietnam having changed the ecosystem so that these fungi have become rampant and that they're natural. From all I've read, no one has the slightest clue as to the reason for those, that they aren't necessarily associated with the yellow rain, which is an immediate effect that the State Department estimates has killed at least 7,000. Others say that when nerve gas is so much more effective, they can't see why anyone would want to use the stuff that it seems to be, but it may just be experimentation with all possible varieties of weapons.
One thing I've been exposed to is nerve gas is extremely expensive, and this yellow stuff may be real cheap to make, and so mm-hmm. you can just drop all or just copious amounts of it and not feel any economic.
Well, the indications I read were that there's no way we can figure out how they could be making it that inexpensively. But I don't know. I'm not sure anyone does. The United Nations has made an investigation which they say is insufficient either to prove or disprove the allegations. They're not completely satisfied with verifying the sources of some of the samples or the diagnoses of the victims. But of course, they did not have immediate access to most of the alleged victims. And the head of the department sponsoring the investigation was a Soviet. So that one is still somewhat in controversy, although many scientists at least are convinced of the nature of the agent and the fact that it could not possibly be there in the samples tested from any natural source. Well, we should spend the rest of the time, I think, on various questions of nuclear warfare, since that seems to be in quite a different class from any of these others. Yes?
The Agent Orange that they always talk about, is mm-hmm. that anything like the Yellow Rain, or what was Agent Orange?
Well, Agent Orange was a herbicide such as farmers use in this country to keep broad-leafed weeds from growing in fields or in forests. It was sprayed over vast areas of jungle to knock all the leaves off the trees so we could see the traffic underneath. And the agent itself, although there'd be some limited tolerance to it, doesn't seem to be the major problem as far as effects on people. It's this unintended small quantity of contaminant that is the main concern. And there seems to be no one has suggested that the dioxin itself is what's being used in Yellow Rain. The things they've identified have been completely different in their molecular structure. And dioxin is not a natural product. These things they found are.
Bill?
Yes?
You know, telling us all the details about all this terrible, awful chemical, to me it seems just enough to know, to hear in general how powerful and awful they are. Why talk about all the details of them? I mean, why hear about each individual different kind and why, and what they do? To me it's enough just to know that they're powerful and that they kill.
Well, I would agree with that. The questions of the particular kinds, though, you need that information if you were voting on whether or not to commit so many $1 million towards their development rather than something else.
I guess it's enough for me to know it's a military weapon and costly.
Well, we're talking about millions of dollars rather than billions of dollars, which is what we often talk about in military weapons, so they may be less costly than a lot of other things.
For me, it makes the issue much clearer. Like nuclear war, to say it's bad news and, you know, that's so far away. But to understand the specifics and exactly what goes on, I find it much closer to reality for me. Yeah.
I'd like to start the section on nuclear weapons with a very recent quotation from Helmut Kohl, who is now the Chancellor of West Germany, about the possible deployment of new intermediate range missiles in West Germany, which would be the Pershing II missiles that Dan had the information about for any of us who wish to write our representatives in Congress. We will abide by our commitment, and we shall do so with the consent of the vast majority of the people. Of course, there will be resistance, perhaps even major resistance, but we will still do it. It is not the West, it is not the Americans that have started the arms race. It is the Soviet Union that keeps on arming, that keeps on deploying batteries of SS-20 missiles. We have now come to a point where when we in the West say this far and no farther. We are not arming with a view to waging war. We have been forced to meet this challenge to be able to defend our peace and freedom. Nuclear arms, terrible as they may be in themselves, by their sheer existence have preserved peace in Europe for the past 35 years. That is one effect alleged of nuclear weapons. As far as effects of nuclear weapons in use, the only experiments, the only possible experiments, were Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The conversion of 1 gram, 1/30th of an ounce, of uranium-235 in Hiroshima gave the effect of blowing up 12,500 tons of TNT, killing 350,000 people. Out of 350,000 in the city, by a few months later, 140,000 were dead, most of them instantly. 5 square miles reduced to rubble, 76,000 buildings in the city had 68% of them destroyed and 24% seriously damaged. There are scenarios available of what would happen if a single weapon, many times the size of that one, from 8 to 100 times the size of, or 200 times the size of that, if detonated over Detroit or Philadelphia, the effects on the civilian population are described in this book, The Effects of Nuclear War, by the Office of Technology Assessment, Congress of the United States. A scenarios for Boston or for Seattle have been supplied by the Physicians for Social Responsibility and for New York City by Jonathan Schell in The Fate of the Earth. I will not go through those, but simply give you some of the conclusions summarized by the Physicians for Social Responsibility. That nuclear war, even a limited one, would result in death, injury, and disease on a scale that has no precedent in the history of human existence. That medical disaster planning for nuclear war is meaningless. There is no possible effective medical response. Most hospitals would be destroyed. Most medical personnel dead or injured. Most supplies unavailable. Most survivors would die. There is no effective civil defense. The blast, thermal, and radiation effects would kill even those in shelters, and the fallout would reach those who had been evacuated. Recovery from nuclear war would be impossible. The economic, ecologic, and social fabric on which human life depends would be destroyed in the U.S., the USSR, and much of the rest of the world. In sum, there can be no winners in a nuclear war. Worldwide fallout would contaminate much of the globe for generations, and atmospheric effects would severely damage all living things.
This is a
full-scale
war?
It says even in a so-called limited war. There are, in this book, scenarios for 4 different scales of nuclear war. One being an attack on a single city. Detroit and Leningrad are used as examples. The second scenario is an attack on oil refineries in each nation only with the intent of crippling the country's economy and not purposely trying to kill a maximum number of people, but that would be one of the side effects. A third one, what's called a counterforce attack, and I'll talk about the definition of that a little later, against military installations as the prime targets in the United States and in the Soviet Union. And finally, a large-scale attack against both military and economic targets, but again, not with the purpose of destroying the maximum number of civilian population. Yes?
The physicians
report.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are people who disagree with that and say we can survive it. We were talking the other day about, I don't know if it's only the Reader's Digest, but there are other people who disagree with that.
Uh-huh.
But how much reading have you done of the, is that a debate? or in your mind, is it settled, or I, you know, how do you find out?
Well, I think it is a difference on the assumptions that they make. Assumptions of whether, in fact, a so-called limited attack would remain at that level and not have any subsequent attacks. Assumptions about the particulars of what would be attacked and what would not. Assumptions about which end of the range of uncertainties you tend to want to believe, I would say, rather than differences about the general nature of what the effects would be. And most of all, I think the difference is on the assumptions of the degree of protection that could be given to the population in advance, which would depend on quite a number of things. The extent of the program that the government would embark on but has not, the extent to which people would pay attention and do what they were told, and the extent to which you would have warning of an attack. Because if you had a short warning but not a very long one, then if you caught everybody in the act of fleeing, the casualties would be much worse than if they just went downstairs and did the best they could. The assumptions in the Office of Technology Assessments report, and they had to rely for their information on studies that were done by the executive branch. They weren't able to start from scratch on this, but take the information available to them. The calculations of the effects, and again, they are dealing only with the effects on the civilian population, not with the military effects. The calculations are very uncertain, and the effects you can't calculate expected to be at least as important as the ones you can. For example, the amount of fire damage as a result of the heat of the blast depends on the weather, depends on the particular configuration of buildings in the area, depends on the particular kinds of weapons that are used in the attack. So they talked here only about the assured destruction and probably understated the effects then. There would be, even from a single weapon, tens of millions of immediate deaths and millions to tens of millions that would also die later. They say they are unable to calculate the likelihood of complete collapse of industrial civilization and of long-term ecological damage. Second, that the impact of even a limited attack is enormous. It might be endurable in that there have been in history wars and epidemics that have been as devastating to a fraction of the population as a limited attack would be calculated to be, but there still might be 20 million deaths. And even if there were no further escalation, they can't predict what the results of that kind of an attack with 20 million immediate deaths would be. That the very uncertainties of the effects, as well as the certainty that whatever the effects are, they will be enormous, is considered to be part of the deterrent effect. That the situations in the United States and the Soviet Union are somewhat different as far as consequences of attack. Their geography of having much more land area and their centralized form of government with emergency planning being considered to be more in effect would favor their survivability. Our economy, on the other hand, is stronger. They live on the edge of economic collapse much more so than we do. And perhaps our production facilities and economic systems are more decentralized than theirs. Their weapons are bigger, so they would kill more people while they were aiming at other targets. Civil defense could save quite a number of lives, but would not necessarily be effective, all depending on how it was done and how much lead time there was. The situation of the survivors would be unprecedented in history. They would lack resources, materials, and skills to use whatever equipment did survive, and some regions would be uninhabitable for a very considerable length of time, and things would get worse before they got better. It would be a race, even in a limited attack, between achieving viability before the remaining stocks were exhausted and everything was gone. And they say that would put us into an economy comparable to the Middle Ages. Jonathan Schell points out that there is a considerable amount of organization of the economy in the Middle Ages, and we couldn't just suddenly reach that stage. Yes?
Something that I couldn't believe, we talked about this at work, and it seemed kind of funny at the time, was someone had gone to a meeting about civil defense for our area and how everyone from the cities was supposed to be coming down to Northfield and how many people could fit into the different stores downtown. And they had lists of things that you should bring along if you were called out for something like this. You were to bring your toothbrush.
Bring
diapers for the baby. You were to leave the pets at home with plenty of food and water. You were to bring your car keys and your credit cards.
Oh, and also you're supposed to let the post office know where to forward your mail.
Oh,
forgot that.
Yeah, there's one that I heard about where they told them they were supposed to bring a crowbar so that they could break into the buildings that were locked and to be able to go into them.
Along with the Physicians for Social Responsibility in the United States, there's a group called the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. They held a conference last summer, 81, near Washington, D.C., and they had a Soviet delegation there, including Brezhnev's former cardiologist and the Deputy Minister of Health, that said the same thing that our own physicians said, with the aid and permission of the Soviet government. A study in 1975 by the National Academy of Sciences has the interesting headline, "Nuclear War Might Not End Human Life," in this report in Chemical and Engineering News. The principal new point was that the major predicted long-term effect would be the increase in ultraviolet radiation due to a reduction in the ozone layer because of the injection of large pulses of oxides of nitrogen up there. And of course, that depends more than anything else on the total amount of weapons detonated, but also on the altitude at which they are detonated. Article last February in the News Tribune, administration officials are claiming the U.S. would recover in just a few years from a nuclear war with the Soviet Union. With proper civil defense, it would take only 2 to 4 years to recover from an all-out nuclear war.
Now that means restoring our economy.
And the dean of the Harvard School of Public Health told the Senate committee last year, recent talk by public figures about winning or even surviving a nuclear war must reflect a widespread failure to appreciate a medical reality. Any nuclear war would inevitably cause death, disease, and suffering of epidemic proportions, and effective medical intervention on any realistic scale would be impossible. The American Medical Association refused to cooperate in any way with the planning for medical response to nuclear attack, saying there is no possibility and you'd only be deluding people to even try to make any plans. It would be, well, there are at present less than 1,000 beds in the United States for severe burn cases, of which there would be hundreds of thousands from a single weapon being exploded. Yeah.
Have any of these groups who say that nuclear war is survivable tried to make any claims of the benefits of nuclear war, that America would be number one?
Well, before answering that, I'd like to go into the idea of the counterforce and skip any detailed description of one of the problems of electromagnetic pulse that would result from any kind of high altitude, or to a lesser extent, low altitude, large nuclear weapon, which would likely shut down the entire power grid of the United States, might make all military communications also impossible, and would prevent any way from distinguishing that single blast from the first stage of an all-out attack. All the warning systems would also be shut down. And this could very easily be accomplished by putting a small plutonium bomb on one of the Soviet satellites that currently go over us all the time anyway, so you wouldn't have any warning. I will forego description of the neutron bomb for the sake of getting into the counterforce question and what that means, which I didn't really understand until I started preparing for this session. This particular book, The Counterforce Syndrome, by Robert C. Aldrich, he was working for Lockheed in a very responsible position for weapons development until he really began to understand what was going on, and then he gave up his career and has devoted himself to trying to share his insights with the rest of us since then. The change, which actually took place officially during the Carter administration, but other reporters say had always been a priority in the minds of the military, is against emphasizing maximizing the destruction of population and economic targets as a deterrent, saying that if you do us, we will still be able to do you completely, and so it isn't worth your while. Going away from that mutual assured destruction, or MAD, to what is called counterforce, namely targeting specifically military targets, and not intending to work the maximum devastation on the civilian population and the economy, which might sound more justifiable by our criteria than the other. However, if you were going to do that, you would want to try to do it completely and effectively. And that seems to be the direction. Try to destroy all of the military capability, nuclear military capability.
This is where we are now.
This is the direction we're officially headed now since Carter, but the military have always had that as their objective, at least since the early 1960s, according to some reports.
So they never had MAD as their official?
The official was MAD, but the military also was interested primarily in military targets, according to some generals and so forth that were involved in it back then. Now, in order to do that, you need to be able to be sure that you can destroy all of the enemy's nuclear weapons on a first strike. If your aim is mutual assured destruction, you don't need accuracy. When a single weapon can vaporize an area miles in diameter, you don't need accuracy. We are not only, according to what's alleged here, but according to all of the descriptions of the weapon systems that I have read, moving towards accuracy within a matter of 300 feet. Which you need only if you're intending to destroy a missile silo, and you only want to destroy a missile silo if it's empty. I mean, if it's full, not if it's empty. This is not a second strike capability, unless you believe that their first strike would be just one or a few, and they would be holding most of theirs in reserve. Now, the weapon systems that are being developed for this purpose are the Trident, with its latest generation of missiles not yet available for the ocean-based system, on the assumption that at present they cannot find and promptly destroy all of our submarines. We seem, according to, again, the various perspectives I've read, to be far ahead of them in submarine detection capability, but we are working on being able to identify every submarine in the ocean. They seem to be working only on protecting their own neighboring waters and shipping lanes with anti-submarine detection and destruction capability. Another is the MX missile, which is intended to have that kind of accuracy. And the third is the potentially airborne or quite mobile cruise missiles, which would have that kind of accuracy, which again is needed only if you're trying to destroy their missiles before they're launched.
Question.
Yes.
The Trident, I know, is a multiple warhead missile. That means you send out one missile and it sort of turns into a whole bunch of them, and
yes,
they all go off in their own direction to be very accurate in their own place. It doesn't sound like those are very selectively small. If we were to think that the Russians were only going to send a few from out of their silos, where would we get that idea if we're making Tridents that send off like 24 or whatever it is right off the bat with the first one we send out?
Well, even without the Trident, if you consider that a bomb, say, 2 to 5 times the size of Hiroshima or Nagasaki would be enough to do in a city or an industrial area with half-mile accuracy, 100 of those would pretty much destroy the bulk of the population and economic capability of the Soviet Union. But if you assume that some of them wouldn't work right and some of them might be destroyed before they got launched and so forth, let's say that you want to have 400 of them available, because there might also be threats from China or other places. We have more than that available in any three of our 31 operational Poseidon submarines already. So the question is, what are the rest of them for? The 30,000 nuclear bombs, the 22,000 tactical nuclear weapons, which could be delivered on shorter ranges by artillery shells or smaller missiles, many of which are already in Europe, 10,000 of them being of the strategic variety that would be delivered either from here or from the air or from the submarines. So the difference of opinion there seems to be largely one of intention and reading of others' intentions, those of the Soviet Union. Does such a capability, which is only useful if we hit them first, actually produce greater security, or does it invite them to try to do it to us first, as best they can before we get any of the all these weapons into use, which they are not yet. Or after they get things as good as those which we're trying to bring about according to national policy, or at least executive branch national policy so far. Question?
Well, you kind of answered it. I was wondering, from what I read, that the Russians' bombs are much larger, much less reliable than ours. Mm-hmm. And so are they also working towards that national policy of making more accurate kind of weapons? Or are they just kind of...
Some say yes. And even that the new generations of missiles they're working on are sufficiently accurate to be effective against our missile silos, which of course ignores the fact that a very major portion of our weapons are for deployment from submarines, much larger proportion than theirs. Most of theirs are still missile silo kinds of things. Yes?
I've heard official and public Kremlin policy is that there's this one of nuclear deterrence, and that nuclear war is not survivable. They have no plans for civil defense,
mm-hmm.
and have stated that they will not be the first to use nuclear weapons, all of which are contrary to the United mm-hmm. States position.
The statement was made by Gromyko before the United Nations that they would not be the first. That was the statement that was made. The other statements you had said are statements also that they have made. Of course, our military are not prone to believe the statements made by the Soviet Union. As far as the civil defense, my reading of the things I have read is that their situation might be comparable to ours, that they talk about extensive plans, which in fact very little has been done about. Allegedly, every student in school is given elaborate civil defense training. In the Sojourners magazine, there was an article by someone who spent considerable time studying in a Russian university, and neither she nor any of the people she talked to heard or said anything about any such things. We have to remember that most of our information comes from the Pentagon, which is interested in using our dollars to improve their capability to perform the mission as they see it. The demands for defense expenditures comprise a bottomless pit that we can never fill. One of the most serious problems we have is the inclination on the part of our military leaders to seek more money by constantly denigrating America's formidable military capability. This hurts our own country and our allies' confidence in us, and might lead the Soviet rulers to make a suicidal misjudgment based on the chorus of lamentations from the Pentagon and defense contractors that we are weak and impotent. Anybody know who said that?
Jackson?
Jimmy Carter, in his book Keeping Faith, as quoted in Time magazine. So, the final perspective. Okay, counterforce is if we are able to do...
Is this our official policy now?
This is the only reason that people can figure out why the specific systems being asked for, the MX, the cruise missile, and the Trident, all three of them,
yeah.
Plus talking about greatly enhancing our own anti-ballistic missile capability, which has been limited by treaty with the Soviet Union to 100 missiles to protect one site, breaking that treaty to improve our capabilities in anti-ballistic missiles so that if we missed any before they were sent off, we could get them before they hit us. It would require sufficient accuracy, sufficient redundancy of maybe send two for each of their missile silos in case something happens to one of them. So that we could strike them, wipe out their nuclear capability, and suffer no nuclear retaliation, or very little at most. Under those terms, a nuclear war would be winnable if those things could be done, and if we did it, started it first.
This is the reason that, in the kind of language that everyone uses, this is the reason that people say we have now begun to create first strike weapons.
Yes. Okay. Exactly.
It's what do we say in response to a discussion like you just, or a description that you just had? What do we officially say when we continue also to say we will not be the first to use them, or we will not start it?
We don't say that anymore. President Reagan has refused to say that, from what I've read.
So what does the Pentagon say would trigger our starting to wipe them out? A hint that they're going to start, or that we're just upset with them, or what?
That's the question.
You've got it.
And I don't have the answer. It would have to be some reading of their intentions. Perhaps if they did evacuate all of their cities in preparation for absorbing a mutual assured destruction and making it less assured.
Or an attack of some other country, their attack of some other country.
Or it could be that the intent would be just to hit some of them to show we could do it and not go and wipe them all out, to say you've gone too far in whatever it is you're doing. Yes?
My personal opinion, I think it's an example of where technology becomes sophisticated and goes ahead of decision making. That means we're able to make these kind of weapons, and then you have to figure out a policy after it's done. Is that a possibility?
I would say that it's a strong possibility.
Do we have satellite nuclear capabilities yet?
You mean to deliver them from satellites? Apparently not.
It won't be long, I don't think.
Isn't there, isn't there a United Nations treaty that we signed that says
yes.
Nuclear devices, I
think. Mm-hmm. And the main thing that has held us back from actual investigation rather than computer simulation of the electromagnetic pulse problem is the treaty that we have signed against atmospheric nuclear blasts. They are in constant readiness, it is said, on Johnson Island to send a missile with a small nuclear weapon a few hundred miles up to see what happens. But unless we choose to break the treaty, or they break it first and we say then we've got to also do the same, since first 10 years or so or more, blowing them up in the atmosphere is something we in the Soviet Union have agreed not to do. Other countries like China, France, have not signed such a treaty and have gone ahead with atmospheric tests.
I thought you said it was relatively simple for them to put the plutonium thing on a satellite that goes over us regularly anyway. Did I misunderstand? They do not have the technology to do that, or we don't?
Well, I think that it's what Eric said, that by treaty, we have agreed not to, and they have agreed not to.
Now that we have the shuttle, space shuttle, it's even easier for us to do it.
And that is allegedly one of the main reasons for developing the space shuttle. Well, not only that, but also for a much, several things that we might choose to try to accomplish in space. Much better indication if, in fact, missiles were launched. Much better detection of all of their submarines at all times, and much better capability to destroy their missiles after they were launched, and capability to destroy their satellites, not only if their satellites might be carrying nuclear weapons, but also to disrupt their communications capability for military purposes. The final perspective I want to give before we have to close here.
In your readings on all these sophisticated new pieces of equipment they're coming out with, if they're still spending money on keeping our SAC airplanes in the sky all
day. Yes.
They are.
Well, the B-52 is intended to be deployed at least until 1990, especially since we haven't started on the B-1, and if we do, it will be that long before they're replacing it. That is definite. Well, and also airplanes for command posts, not only commander-in-chief, but by the way, only one of the four aircraft that would be the president's flying command post in case of an all-out war has been hardened against effects of electromagnetic pulse, so one high-altitude weapon might cut off the president from all communications if he were up there to be safe. Furthermore, the dust from all of the nuclear bombs might in fact destroy the jet engines the way the dust from Mount St. Helens destroyed a couple of engines, but the plane happened to have a couple more that still worked. So there are some alleged vulnerabilities yet, even with what we have and rely on at our present stage.
Is the ultra-low frequency transmitter that they keep talking about building in throughout all of Michigan, is that because of their fears about the electromagnetic?
No, I think that would be for positive location of all submarines.
Oh, okay. I thought it was...
It still doesn't have any area that has not rebelled. They still have a place in Wisconsin, Michigan, called,
yeah,
it's called an arm from the grave, and that, and it's now ELF, right? Mm-hmm. But it's had other names.
There are some interesting acronyms like Deep Underground Missile Basing, DUMB. But, well, the one perspective I do want to close with that puts these differences of opinion of survivability of nuclear war in quite a different perspective, I think, is the main thesis, I think, of The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell, which is, although we cannot prove that an all-out nuclear war would destroy the human race, neither can we prove that it would not. He has some scenarios where if the bulk of the population of the United States is in fact destroyed, and 60% of the population is so concentrated it could be destroyed with 100 or two, come to the point with the thousands of missiles that the Soviet Union has, where you might be hunting down each survivor with a separate nuclear missile. In that case, added with the fact of fallout contamination, of vulnerability to disease from non-lethal radiation doses, of complete lack of not only medical but sanitary facilities, with hundreds of millions of corpses, that in fact with also the destruction of not only mammals that would be sensitive, comparable to us, but trees are also have comparable sensitivities to radiation, with the prospect of all forests that were dry enough being set ablaze instantly with a massive attack, that in fact survival, not just in the United States, but if you added other parts of the world, that the effects on the ecosystem as a whole might be such, he calls the first section a Republic of Insects and Grass, that survivability on the whole planet might not be possible for the human race. Says you can't prove that that would happen, but you cannot prove it would not. And the possibility of its happening, morally, should be the same as the certainty of its happening. We don't know that it would not mean extinction for the entire human race forever, which is quite an entirely different thing from our own individual death or that of any number of billions of people you might want to talk about. What objectives are there to justify that risk? And another interesting question is, on the whole basis of the mutual mutual assured destruction, you know, suppose we were hit first, and the whole deterrent effect is making them believe that if we were hit first, we would do the same to them. But once we were hit first, what possible purpose would there be in responding and destroying all of them? Be no deterrence anymore. Nothing but revenge. And when it might mean the difference between extinction of the human race or not, what a responsibility we put on one person. One. Well, maybe two.
Personally, I would think that they must realize, you know, the people in charge, the people that are propagating this, what I seem to think is insanity, they must realize all these positions. They must. And if they're going to keep on doing it, they must have a better reason for doing it, I would think. I mean, they're not nuts, I hope.
What does that say about us who elect people who we know are trigger happy to be in the position?
The notion that we could beat Russia in a full-tilt thermonuclear war was spawned more than 30 years ago in the corridors of the State Department by a courtly, fastidiously dressed man named Paul Nitze. Still in his 30s, Nitze arrived in Washington, D.C. just before Pearl Harbor. So forth. Nitze now is one of Reagan's two chief negotiators in the strategic arms reduction talks with the Soviets.
And another factor that in several lectures you're holding on the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the evidence is that there is a certain movement of history that ended up pulling people along with it instead of people being in control. And some say that's already happened with the nuclear arms race. You can't say that there are human beings that are actually making decisions, but history tends to move in a direction that pulls human beings almost helplessly along.
Well, Tolstoy articulated that rather thoroughly in the second epilogue to War and Peace, that the higher up you get in the chain of the command, the less possible individual choice actually existed.